Hello, my name's Jane Dacre. Welcome to the second season of Medical Women Talking. The podcasts are made up of conversations with some amazing women doctors who've had incredible careers. Being a woman and a doctor can be challenging, but these conversations are designed to be shared to help those women aspiring to fulfilling careers and to leadership roles. We hear a lot of negative stuff about medicine these days, but these inspiring stories show us that medicine can still be brilliant. Listen and be inspired. Today, I'm talking to Meghana Pandit. Meghana started her career as an obstetrician and gynaecologist, but got into NHS management. She's now the chief executive of Oxford University Hospitals. This is an extraordinary achievement. She's the first Indian woman chief executive of an NHS trust.
Let me start by saying that I never imagined in my entire life and career that I would be a CEO, let alone a CEO at Oxford University Hospitals. And there's a reason for that. So I started my medical training. I was born and brought up in India, in Bombay, which is now Mumbai. And I went to medical school in Mumbai. I was a national scholar in 1984. And I was in one of the top medical schools in Bombay, linked to the King Edward Memorial Hospital. It was a great five years, you know, lots of learning and lots of fun. And then I met someone and I fell in love with them. And that person lived in Oxford. So I moved to Oxford. I got married. I moved to Oxford in 1991. And the day I arrived here, it was minus 11. And I was coming from 35 degrees Celsius. And it was a culture shock. But of course, I had traveled widely before with my parents. And it was just the feeling that this is not a holiday. I'm here and my life has changed. That was the feeling that suddenly sort of caught me unawares. But I've had right from that day absolutely fantastic support from my husband and my family. And that is pretty much what has enabled me to do what I have done and what I do today. And that's from every aspect, from the way I was raised, the values that I have and I bring with me every day. And when things don't go so well, the support that I need. So, of course, when I said I trained in Mumbai and I had to come here, I had to sit the plab. And that was, you know, that was a culture shock. My parents-in-law were both GPs. And it was in those days I sat in with my mother-in-law in her surgery, GP surgery, and sort of just got to understand how we interact with people, how we, you know, take a history and examine people, very different to what happens in different parts of the world, actually, in the way it's conducted. And I sat the plab, and my first job was at St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington. But before I get to that, I'll tell you the connection with Oxford. So I was living in Oxford, and my husband is also a doctor, and he was doing his DPhil at the time, but he wrote to the professor of medicine in Oxford and said that his wife, new wife, was sitting the plab, and could I shadow him on his firm? And he graciously accepted me on his firm, and that was Professor John Ledingham, who is absolutely fantastic, and I will never forget the ward rounds that he did on busy medical wards and his team. And I shadowed him. And I used to walk down the academic corridor where my office currently is as the chief executive. And, you know, it was just a sort of a feeling where I've got my entire career to do. I still have to sit the plab and pass it. And I'm sitting in the Cairns Library in the John Ratcliffe Hospital. And, you know, what's going to happen? I just have to focus on one thing at a time. Anyway, I passed the exam and I said to John, I said, I want to be an obstetrician gynecologist. And he looked at me and he said, why would you do that? Why would anyone want to do that?
Well, I have to say, I was going to ask you.
So I said, no, that's what I want to do. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to be a gynecologist and obstetrician because I always felt there was a fantastic mix of medicine and surgery. And there was always an emotional component And there was that quality of life component, which I wanted to improve for women. And one of my aunts was a gynecologist. Actually, she I was born in her clinic. But anyway, so he said, well, if that's what you want, that's fine. But look, the world is your oyster. And he wrote to me, and I still have that letter. He said, the world is your oyster. You can do whatever you want. And, you know, there you go. So my first job was at St. Mary's Hospital in Paddington. And those early influences working with Dame Leslie Regan, Guy Thorpe-Beeston, John Smith, and Frank Loeffler, they were the forming days. I mean, they gave me such a solid framework and base that, you know, it was a springboard for the rest of my life, really, not just career. And the first day, on the first morning, when I went onto the ward, and Dame Leslie Regan came, she was the consultant. And the first thought I had in my head, you know, was, I want to be like that one day. And it was extraordinary. And yeah, I don't think I don't think I'll ever get to be like her, but it's taught me.
Oh, I don't know. I'm interviewing Leslie Regan as well.
Okay, so, well, there you go.
We'll have you both. She'll you be can very tell proud.
Her that. Yeah, you can tell her that. But anyway, so that was a really good time. And then I did lots of SHO jobs, as one does. Lots of hard work, commuting from Oxford to London, and then commuting. And then I spent 2 years in Oxford as this SHO. I had some trouble, I have to say, in passing my part one. I just wasn't interested in doing exams. I just moved countries. I was, you know, I was changing. My life had changed. And I was just wanting to relax, really. But I kept sitting the part one MRCOG. I eventually passed it. And the next really good phase in my career was when I went to America. I went to Ann Arbor, Michigan. My husband and I both went there for a year to work. I was visiting lecturer there with Professor John Delancey. He's the professor of urogynecology who actually described, the first person to describe the continence mechanism in women and the pelvic floor anatomy. And I worked with him, and, you know, he is an amazing person. I mean, obviously, I'm still in touch with him. Firstly, the resources available for research in America were eye-wateringly different to what we had or still have. And the learning in terms of just anatomy and clinical work, different operative techniques and research methodology from him was really fantastic. And the thing he said to me when I got there was, what do you want to achieve? You know, you have a small baby. The weather here is dreadful. You'll want to travel. So what do you want to achieve in your year with me? And I said, well, if I get at least one peer-reviewed publication and an opportunity to speak at a large conference, I'd be happy. And he said, that's fine. We'll get that done. And you know, all that learning about research and learning about prioritization, learning about how do you speak when you're speaking to an audience of 2,000, you know, all of that. And I got 3 papers out of it. I got I spoke at large conferences, and I won 2 prizes. I won actually the Young Gynecologist of the Year award. And I was I received that at the conference, RCOG annual conference in Cape Town in 2000 or 1999. And that was a very proud moment. But when I came back to, and this is where it all sort of started going a little wrong for me, and I don't know what I'd ever done to make it go wrong, because I came back, I had a small baby, and I was doing 16-hour shifts, and that was really difficult. That was the start of the different hours of working. And believe me, I was commuting from Oxford to another hospital and doing 5 p.m. to 9 a.m. shift, 7 nights in a row. Now, those are undoable.
So how far were you commuting? People often have struggles about
an hour's commute.
An hour added to your long day.
Both ways, hours.
With a small baby.
Yeah. So I chose to go flexible at that point. And I wasn't treated very well when I said, can I train flexibly? Anyway, I said, you know, I carried on. I said, that's what I have to do for my family and to continue my career. And I... when I got to CCT, I had people say to me things like, your face does not fit. I had people saying to me, we're not going to give you a job here because you'll take away our private practice. you know, all sorts of things. And I just thought, well, why would I want to work in this unit if that's what they say to me? I'm not going to let go of what I've learned from John Delancey and what I've learned since then, 3 years. So 4 years of solid urogynecology learning. Why would I give that up? That's not the right thing to do. And why would I want to work with people who tell me my face doesn't fit? So
this was back in the UK, was it?
Back
in the NHS.
Yes, yes.
And in London or outside London?
In the hospital where I'm the CEO now.
Okay, gosh.
Yep. Yeah.
Don't get mad, get even, Megan.
I took a job in a DGH. I went to, because they actually phoned me and said, we want to advertise a urogyny job. Are you interested? And I said, yes. And that was an hour long commute again from Oxford. So I went there and I was a consultant there for 9 years, actually. And it was hard work. I mean, it's bad enough to be a new consultant, but this was really difficult. The unit was going through a bad time. There were, you know, we got to sort of 2 years, 3 years into job in my role as consultant and found that there were poor outcomes. You know, the trainees were giving bad GMC survey results, lots of complaints, disharmony amongst consultants and unhappy staff generally. And I thought, this can't be right. Why is this happening? And I said, I went to the medical director and I said, I'd like to be the clinical director, please. And they said, you know, it was very wise advice. And they said, look, you've been a consultant for what, 3 years? I think you need to sort of maybe go and get some training somewhere about how to be a clinical director. And then we can think about it. So I did just that. I went to the King's Fund and I did a 2 week course on how to be a clinical director. And about 6 months later, I came back to the medical director and I said, well, I've done the course you recommended, so I would still like to be a clinical director, please. And he said, okay, well, look, the current person's term is going to come up and we're going to re-advertise, but they're likely to apply again. And I said, that's fine. I'm used to competition. And I said to all my colleagues, I'm going to put my hat in the ring to be a clinical director. And one of the senior colleagues, a colleague, said to me, "Ooh, if I were you, I wouldn't apply because the top corridors told me that I'm going to be given the job. So you will only be embarrassing yourself by turning up to the interview and not getting it." And I said, well, that's fine. You know what?
This was a competitor.
Yes.
A competitor.
Yes, a competitor. So I said, no, that's fine. I will be interviewed and I'll see you there. And of course, he didn't turn up to the interview. He just wanted perhaps me to withdraw so that there would be no obvious person and then he might have been asked. I don't know. But anyway, so
did you want to do it? Why did you want to do it?
I'm coming to that. So I wanted to do it because I had a strong desire to get things right. I did not want to just complain about the outcomes and things not being positive. I didn't want to sit in the background saying, ooh, somebody else is not doing it right, or somebody else is not providing me help with digital, somebody else is not providing me help with admin support. I wanted to say, okay, somebody needs to fix it. And I'm willing to give it a try to fix it. And I have gone and got the training about how to be a clinical director. And I am putting my hand up to say, I will try and fix it. Here are my ideas. Here are my ideas to remove waste from processes, to make things efficient, to create frameworks of behavior, create frameworks for trainees and create a program for trainees and all this sort of thing. And I did get that job as clinical director. And I was very fortunate to work with a newly appointed head of midwifery and a newly appointed general manager. And they're still my friends to this day. And we, over the next 3 years, literally working with the team that we had, the people in the department, we turned it around. And, you know, I was no longer standing in front of the television camera apologizing to a family. You know, we were celebrating good outcomes. So that was a really nice thing. And I thought I'd really liked it. And I had a very busy clinical practice at that time. And then the organization were appointing divisional directors. So I was asked if I would like to be a divisional director, and I became a divisional director for Women and Children's Division. And it sort of gave me a buzz. I felt that I was being effective on a larger scale, that I was able to influence outcomes for a larger number of people than the person right in front of me. You know, of course, I loved my clinical practice, you know, and I loved my patients. I loved being in theatres operating, but this was just a different challenge. And I found it very stimulating to try and make an impact and a positive change for in people's lives. And I thought, okay, I'm doing all these things, but I wonder if there's a theory that describes all these changes and behaviors I'm trying to make, because I didn't always get it right then. You know, sometimes I wanted to just go ahead and set in a pace setting way. Other times I sort of maybe didn't speak to the right people at the right time. And I thought, let me explore if there's a theory. And that's where the MBA comes in. So I looked around for an MBA, and I found the Oxford Brookes Global MBA program, which could be done as I worked. And I took that up in 2011, in the summer of 2011, I started doing it. And suddenly one day I saw that there was a job being advertised at University Hospitals Coventry and Warwickshire as the chief medical officer. And I thought, well, that would be a nice thing to do. I really like what I'm doing. And then the MBA is fascinating. I'm learning a lot. And I remember people saying, well, why would you want to do that? You've got a great job. You're a divisional director. You're doing so well, and your patients love you, and your colleagues in the hospital are great, and the hospital is going great guns. They're going to join up with New Buckingham University soon. So why do you want to move? And I said, well, because I think I like the thought of being a chief medical officer in a bigger hospital to have a bigger impact. And I went there and I was interviewed and I got the job. And I thought, I literally, to this day, I feel like I hit the lottery on that day when the CEO of that hospital, Andy Hardy, phoned me to say, I'd like to offer you the job of the CMO. I could not believe it. And that really changed my life, because when I went in, I didn't know very much, but I had very supportive colleagues. I had two deputies who were appointed before I started the job, and a director of quality. And Paul, Andy, and Mike were so supportive and superb in the way they shepherded me through the first 18 months. And, you know, I felt, you know, when one moves hospitals at that level, you feel like you're an outsider. You come into a new family and everybody's looking at you going, ooh, what are you going to do or say? And you don't really know what's gone on in that hospital. You don't know who gets on with whom or who is married to whom. And many people are in a hospital working together. You don't have that history. But I think that helped me, and the support that I helped certainly did. And I was there for almost 7 years as a CMO, and I cried when I left, because it was like a family.
Did you carry on your clinical work at that stage?
I did. So when I went there in 2012, I stopped doing obstetrics, but I carried on doing one day of gynecology. It was a big job. University Hospitals Coventry had about 400 consultants then, a staff of about 8,000, and based on two sites, one in Coventry and one in Rugby, and linked to Warwick Medical School. So it was a big place, but you know, I thought, okay, I could do one day of gynecology. But so I carried on doing that. I think in 2018, probably I changed to just to half a day rather than one whole day. I stopped operating, I think, in about 2015, but I carried on doing outpatient procedures and a clinic. And I had great colleagues there. And I learned a lot whilst I was CMO. One of the things I did was I started a master's program at Warwick University in healthcare management, which is now oversubscribed. It's a great master's program. I still teach on it. I also managed to be there exactly at the right time when there was a partnership with Virginia Mason Institute. Virginia Mason Institute is a small hospital in Seattle who are regarded as one of the safest hospitals in North America following their adoption of lean methodology, which they learned from Toyota Motor Industry. And they've been doing that for 15 years. And Jeremy Hunt, who was then Secretary of State for Health, had been there and really was impressed with what they did and said, well, I will fund. He funded five hospitals to be partnered with Virginia Mason Institute so that the NHS could understand and learn that, about lean methodology and waste reduction. And you know, there were people cynical about it, but actually that has been a fantastic program. And that's what gave me my passion for quality improvement. And I firmly believe that quality improvement is about respect for all, respect for the people who do the work and enabling them to make change. And my role as you know, the chief executive is to facilitate the change that they want to happen and unblock any obstacles that they have in their way. What I also did when I was in Coventry was led change programs. So here I was, you know, doing my MBA and actually using what I'm learning on the MBA to translate that and implement that into the work I was doing in the hospital. So I wrote, I led on the writing of the clinical strategy. I led change programs. And one of the change programs I led along with Mark Radford, who was the chief nurse at the time with me in Coventry, was getting emergency care right. And we saw the A&E performance improve from about low 80s to 96% within 6 weeks because of this change program that we led. And it stayed like that for about seven, eight months.
The four-hour wake. Wait.
Yeah. And the whole country was watching. And I remember going talking about the change program everywhere. And it was such a buzz in the organization because everybody's work got easier and better. And patients were, you know, served a lot better than waiting on in the corridor. I also led finance improvement programs, and I also led operational productivity, particularly in theaters. So I was doing a lot, and I became a deputy CEO at the time as well. But I think success as a CMO, as the chief medical officer, really came from being, from compassionate leadership. So really from listening, understanding, and empathizing with people, from creating supportive environments for staff, for really implementing very well quality improvement in the organization, learning to fail, and failure is not bad. If you fail, you move forward fast. I think that's really important to understand, but also maintaining a relentless focus on patient safety and staff welfare and always putting patients at the center of everything we did, and I still do. So that really thing, I think, is where success came as a CMO. And then Oxford came calling. So in January 2019, I became chief medical officer at Oxford. And I remember being told that my main task when I was appointed was to improve the safety culture in the organization. And I thought, okay, so I've come back after 16 years when I was told my face doesn't fit and I have to now change, improve the safety culture. Isn't that interesting? But that was fine.
I remember visits to Oxford before you came.
Yes.
I remember having the discussion with you. It was a very unhappy place. So it's really interesting. Anyway, carry on.
So I didn't say, well, here I come having won the, you know, HSJ Patient Safety Award for Coventry. Here I've come and I'm going to change everything. That clearly was not the way. I think I was wiser now and slightly different from when I had been a clinical director. And I said, okay, look, here are the things we could think about doing, you know, and we introduced safety messages. So every Tuesday, a safety message has gone out since February 2019 in this organization from the chief medical officer and chief nurse every single Tuesday without fail. And these are just learning points. They're bullet points that are expressed as learning from incidents or from mortalities. I started a pilot of a patient safety response team where senior doctors, nurses, and governance practitioners review the harm incidents that have happened in the previous 24 hours with a view to making sure that the area is safe today, that there is no ongoing risk, and that duty of candor has been delivered. And also doing a quick review of why this happened and is there any learning from it so it doesn't happen again. We started that as a pilot and people said, oh, but how are we going to do this? There are four sites, you know, it may never work, you know, da, da, da. And now I don't have to go to it. It carries on every single day as a patient safety review team. People have written emails to say, thank you very much for this. We cannot believe how supported we feel as staff. And, you know, as a result of all of these things, including safety huddles, there is no blame culture now, whereas there was previously. So the reporting rates are high, the learning is high, and for instance, the number of never events has dropped sharply. There was something like 11 when I came, and then there were two, and, you know, gradual drop from 11 to 6 and 2, and now we are stabilized, you know, at around 3 or 4 or 5. But there is learning.
So you've moved up now to being chief executive, but you did it as an interim to start to.
I'm coming to that. So within a year of being starting all those safety changes, COVID came in March 2020, and it was really about continuing those things and not saying, oh my God, there's chaos, there's COVID, we need to stop this and just focus on something else. I said, no, we've got to keep going with the safety because this is more important now than ever. And I think that's what sort of made sure that this organization realized that the focus was on safety. And then after 3.5 years as a CMO, I thought, you know, my predecessor, my CEO retired, and there was an opportunity for somebody to be a CEO. And I said, I put my hand up because I've done 10 years as CMO. I think I've learned lots. I think I have things I can offer, and I would like to do it. So I was initially appointed as a fixed term CEO for 1 year. But within 6 months, the trust board decided to start a process of appointment of a substantive CEO. And I was interviewed competitively again, and I was appointed in March as a substantive CEO here at Oxford. And it's a privilege to be in this role. It's a fantastic role. There's lots to give and lots to get done. And I presented a vision to the organization and the board, which is based fundamentally around our people, patient care, productivity, and partnerships. And, you know, there has to be change. And that change has to comes in several forms. One, I would definitely say that there should be kindness to each other and an end to bullying and discrimination. There should be introduction of management and leadership in the medical curriculum, which I'm working with Oxford University now, which is the best medical school in the world. And I really feel that people should be open to change and be engaged with change and regard every challenge as an opportunity to shine, because, you know, that's what challenges are. And humility is a lot better than arrogance. And working as a team is really important. And I think some people realize it too late, but teamwork actually does work. And ultimately, I think fundamentally, it's all about compassion, collaboration, and clear communication, so that better never stops.
Fantastic. So that's such a wonderful story. I notice your is it alliteration, your partnership, patient care.
Yes.
And then compassion, courtesy.
Yes.
I used to do that, the RCP, so I could remember.
Yeah.
So, but it is, you describe it all really well. So can I just, we're coming towards the end now, but I just want to ask you some sort of specific questions in terms of general reflections, which is, highs and lows. Is there anything you would like to highlight as maybe the best bit and the worst bit in that career journey?
So the highs definitely are my time in Coventry and in America, and also being the CEO. Those are my highs, yes. Absolute highs. The lows are, I've alluded to them, the lows are about being, you know, bullied as a junior doctor, and just, it was very hard. It was very hard at times when I was bullied.
And so was that, it sounds as if some of that was around the time that you were a bit more vulnerable, you had a young child. So how many children do you have, and has the impact, has there been an impact of you being so successful in your professional career on your family life? Some people say that it causes difficulties.
So, I don't think it, it may be that, I mean, I don't know if I had more children, would I be in the same place I'm now? I don't know. It's very difficult to answer because I don't think it bears. I have one child. I have a 25-year-old son who is absolutely fantastic. But you see, my issue was slightly different, which was that my husband was in a very busy specialty as well, which is anesthetics. So he was doing anesthetics while I was doing obstetrics and gynecology. And those are the two busiest specialties.
Crazy.
Yes.
Crazy.
And also, unfortunately, my parents-in-law passed away early. So what that meant was that we were entirely reliant on nannies and au pairs. And that, I think that it wasn't my career. It was that that meant that we only had one child.
Yeah, and childcare is an absolute nightmare to lots of young women coming through. I think it's even worse now.
Yeah, I mean, there were times when I remember a time when I was operating and actually my husband was anaesthetizing that list and suddenly my bleep went off. And it was that my son had fallen in the nursery. It was a hospital nursery, but he'd fallen and he needed attention. So, you know, we both looked at each other and thought, who's going to go? Who's going to leave? So I had to then say to the consultant, can you please take over? I've got to go because my son needs attention. You know, it's those sorts of things. It's very difficult.
Absolutely. It is very difficult. So when those things have happened, just that last thing now, what's helped you? What's helped you to get through? You've mentioned some mentors, but just generally, what do you think helps?
So my husband has been an absolute rock. He has helped every single time. And then just doing things like, you know, going on holidays. I like to cook, so I cook a variety of cuisines, which I absolutely love doing. And I can switch off, I can play the music and cook, and that takes me to another world. And then the other thing I do more recently over the last 10 years is fishing. I think that is the most therapeutic thing in the world, and I like to fish. My husband likes to ski. My son loves skiing, so we go to North America, and I go fishing, and they go skiing, and it's wow. Amazing.
Fly fishing.
Yes.
Fly fishing.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Fantastic.
Yes. I shall do a lot of it when I'm retired, which I do. Yes.
Excellent. So Meghna, it's been a pleasure to talk to you today. So just to remind everybody that Meghna is the first female CEO in Oxford and the first female person of colour who's the chief executive of a large acute trust. So Meghna, thank you so much for talking to me today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Medical Women Talking. It's been a privilege to spend time with all these medical women. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this season. Don't forget, there are many other interviews in season 1.